Hello and welcome to Criterion
Close Up.
This is episode 12, and of course, I am Mark Kearney. I'm here with my co-host, as always, Mr. Aaron West.
Hello, hello.
How you doing, Aaron?
Pretty good. Ready to get in some Cronenberg.
Excellent. Yes.
It's a Halloween, scary October.
Yeah, it's very cool. We're talking about David Cronenberg's The Brood today. But before we get into that, we have to welcome our esteemed guest, who we are very excited to have here today, Mr. Brian Sauer. Hello, Brian.
Hello, gentlemen.
Welcome, Brian.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Thrilled to have you, man.
You're
the perfect guest for this episode.
Absolutely. And so Brian is of the website. We actually talked about you last week, of course. Yeah, I think
you
we
did.
Talk about him every week.
I really appreciated that. That was very kind.
I think we've talked about Brian every week.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely. So Brian is of RupertPupkinSpeaks.com and also Criterion Cast, the off-the-shelf weekly podcast. So again, Brian, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself? And as we always do, and this was your idea, was to bring in our Criterion connections, how you first got started with Criterion. We love hearing that. So,
About me, just a long time, you know, film nerd, you know, worked at, video stores through high school and college, and actually after college a bit. So I've just always been sort of obsessed with movies. I studied film in college, and it's just my favorite thing basically. And, you know, the blog was sort of born out of that. It just, I feel like there's so many movies that don't get properly recognized. And it's, there's just too much. And I get that things can get lost. And so the blog is just a way for me to sort of, you know, spotlight things that I feel like, you know, could use some extra attention. And then I've sort of, it's been fun to sort of involve other bloggers and writers and people that I admire in creating these little lists of movies based on different genres, categories, years, what have you. I mean, it's been going strong since circa 2009 or 10, so there's been a lot of lists there, and if people want to go over and check it out. Right now, this year, I've been running underrated year lists based on 2015. You know, we started with 85, then went back to 75, 65, 55, and 45 is next. So, you know, just movies from 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago. Anyway, that's what's going on now. But as far as my Criterion connection, it goes way back to when I was in college. Our media center had some Criterion Laserdiscs. They had Taxi Driver and Raging Bull. And my friend, my good friend, worked at the media center, and he dubbed those onto VHS tapes, so you could watch them with the commentary from Scorsese. And that first commentary, I heard Taxi Driver, and that just blew my mind. That was one of my favorite movies, and still kind of is. And hearing his commentary on, I still think it's one of the greatest commentaries ever, you know, and just the way it was put together and everything, it just was such a neat experience to watch. I don't watch movies with the commentary. I more listen to commentaries now. Like, I'll put them on in the background, but at the time, you're watching the movie with the commentary, and it was just something else. It was this whole other experience. So that was the first time that I was exposed to it, and then when I moved to Los Angeles in 1999, I got a job at a video store called Laser Blazer. And it was an exclusively DVD and Laserdisc store. So we had tons of Criterions everywhere. And since I was already aware of them, you know, it was very exciting, but everybody at the place just loved Criterion. And so we would just always talk about Criterion and get excited when, you know, new stuff came in, and I could take out the Laserdiscs myself. I ended up getting a cheap player, and, I would just rent them all the time and record the commentaries and whatnot. So, and then I started, you know, with my my meager salary, I would start buying Criterions, you know. So it started back then.
Awesome. Thanks, Brian. Well, we're really excited to have you on. It's we've been talking about this for a while. So, again, welcome to Criterion Close Up. And thanks for listening, too.
Yeah, yeah. And thanks for the retweets, Brian.
So. Yeah, always my pleasure. That. My pleasure.
So this episode, we're going to be talking about 1979's The Brood, a recent release from Criterion from David Cronenberg. And tying in with that, we are talking about early Cronenberg. So mainly the 1970s, but we're also including one of his early films, Stereo, from 1969. So looking forward to that. But before we get into that, of course, we talk about a few. We have some thank yous, corrections, and some news, of course. So, Aaron, I think you had a Criterion story. Of course, we did want to thank our guest from last week, Christina Dion from the Speakeasy blog. So thank you very much for being on, Christina. That was a really fun episode. Great to talk about. Again, that was one of our Criterion close-up episodes. But, Aaron, I'm going to kick it to you to talk a little bit about the blogosphere.
Yeah, well, Criterion. Christina was great. And yeah, the blogosphere kind of reacted a lot. There are a lot of nice comments. We get a lot of those, and it's always nice to find a new audience to chime in. And Christina, we talked after the show, and she told me a story that I thought was fun, that one of her first discs was Grand Illusion. And of course, that was my first disc. And she loaned it to a friend, and that friend gave it back. Or that friend never gave it back. So I said, that is the worst friend ever.
Oh, yeah.
Don't know what happened with that. I don't know if they're still friends, but it was a good episode, and I think people responded to it. So looking forward to having Christina back again sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have another episode that we released, but we kind of released it during the week, so I don't know if that's, you know, how that works. But Aaron, you had a nice conversation about a Godard film.
Yeah, I talked to myself. The best conversation.
Hello, self.
Yeah, it was actually, it was just probably most people that hear this won't have heard that because it just came out on the eve of us recording.
Right.
And it's just, you know, another 25 minutes of me talking about a movie. And this one, I wasn't sure. In fact, I lied. I said I wasn't going to do foreign films. But then I found some things to engage with Weekend. And I thought it went okay. I've already had some feedback that was pretty positive.
Cool.
We'll do some more. And I think the next one will be with another person. That'll be next week.
Cool. Looking forward to that. Hope folks are enjoying the shortcuts. And of course, we have a couple of corrections. First, talking about podcasting last week as it related to blogging, I had mentioned that podcasting started in 2008. And this is it's sometimes when you're talking, your brain is doing one thing and your mouth is doing another. So podcasting, I said, started in 2008. It did actually start in 2004 originally, kind of got going in 2005 when it finally got into to iTunes. So just a little correction there. And we also got a lot of feedback about Canadian films, Aaron.
Yeah, I kind of, a lot of these off-the-cuff comments I make on the show without thinking kind of get me in trouble, but I just comment on how I thought Cronenberg was really, Cronenberg and Madden were the only Criterion Canadian directors, but I was corrected. Actually, there are a lot of connections, and I didn't write them down, but Glenn Ford is Canadian, and he's in two movies, Jabal and 310 to Yuma. And then there are a lot of movies set in Canada. The 49th Parallel was brought up, and there are a number of others, too many to mention. But I thought, I was like, wow, Canada's out there. So I'm still doing Cronenberg for, as we are today, but for Christina's blogathon. But it was still cool. And big week for them, too. Oh, and I should shout out that, Christina announced her blogathon, Christina and Ruth, for O Canada. And she actually signed you up based on your claim on the episode. So I'll put that link in the show notes. And if you're into Canada or into blogging or really engaged with last week's episode, then feel free to jump in.
Cool. And lastly, we have a short Criterion blogathon update.
Yeah, it's rolling. I posted an announcement this week, and we're going to unveil the schedule next week. Not sure exactly how we're going to do it. We talked about six posts. We talked about, which might be too much, we talked about three posts, maybe just one post. But at some point, you'll see the actual schedule for who's doing what and who's hosting what and all that. So almost ready to go.
Cool. So let's move into the news. The first thing was very interesting. We've got a little exclusive from Costco coming, it looks like, with a Criterion connection. And we have to thank our friend, of course, Ryan Gallagher of Criterion Cast for confirming this. There are, looks like, some two Criterion box sets that are going to be coming in November, just in time for Christmas. And they are, there's the Rock Box, it looks like it's called, that includes Hard Day's Night, Quadrophenia, Gimme Shelter, and Monterey Pop. And there's also a Hitchcock box that will include The Man Who Knew Too Much, The 39 Steps, The Lady Vanishes, and Foreign Correspondent. So no new titles, nothing really new. It looks like it's probably just a package of the, I'm not sure if it's going to include the plastic cases, if they're going to redo anything, but it might just be a slipcase. So cool stuff.
Yeah, and the rumor price is $59.99. I remember seeing it earlier in the week and thought, oh, this is just somebody photoshopping, because, you know, there are a lot of Criterion photoshoppers out there.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's fake. But then when I saw Ryan confirmed it, and apparently from somebody in Criterion, it looks real. And I almost wish that I could, and I've heard a lot of this, I wish I could buy the box alone, because I own all the films already for each set. But I would... But the boxes look really neat, especially that Hitchcock box.
Yeah,
it's really cool.
Yeah, really classy.
So, as far as you guys know, those will be exclusives.
As far as we know, yeah, we haven't. We really don't know much. In fact, I hope you ask Ryan next week.
I definitely will. We'll discuss at length.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll be part of the conversation. I'm hoping that, you know, like you said, Aaron, maybe on the Criterion shop on Criterion.com, maybe they'll offer it. But if it's a Costco exclusive, they may just keep it, you know, try to get people in the door. So we'll see. Be interested
to
see what happens.
A lot of people would love those boxes. And I think it's going to be more like the Wallace Shawn Andre Gregory box, just holding the discs in.
Right.
So.
Right. We'll see what happens. So next, some more information about Vim Vendors, Aaron.
Yeah, well, it seems like every week we're talking about Vim Vendors, and we've speculated that we'll be seeing a lot of vendors over the next couple of years, and we have, I think you could call it official confirmation from vendors that that all these discs are coming, or all these films that they're touring are coming to Criterion at some point. There was an article on BoingBoing.net. It was Vim Vendors looking back, and he basically, they put Criterion releases to come. So, and we already got The American Friend, which was earlier than I expected. So, you know, I think Until the End of the World, The Road Trilogy, all those probably, I'd say we could get some of them this year.
And, sure.
Maybe some next year. So, looking forward to that.
Yeah, it'll be the year of vendors. So, and we've talked about Krzysztof Kieslowski quite a bit, and we had. I'm going to call, I think Dan O'Hara is probably the Sherlock Holmes of Criterion, because he always comes up with these great nuggets. So a little shout out to Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
He was watching TCM one night, and he noticed that on the 1985 No End by Kieslowski, a Janus Films logo appeared. So that kind of points to the fact that this is going to come from Criterion. Maybe it'll be the next one to follow up Blind Chance, which is part of that that Kino box set from before that is out of print. And just for folks that may not know, again, that old Kino box set includes the films, a short film about love, a short film about killing. It did include Blind Chance, Camera Buff, No End, and The Scar. So I'm thinking that there's a good chance that those films are maybe all coming from Criterion. So thanks for Dan for picking that up and letting us know.
Yeah, it's great, Dan. And I think... Well, we know the Decalogue is coming. I think they've confirmed that. And a short, the two short films are sort of tangent, peripherally.
Right.
That word just would not come out. They're peripherally related to the Decalogue. They're expanded upon.
Right.
And so I think it would be a good fit. Now, I've seen No End, and I think it's a great film. But I saw the Kino, and I think that... You know, the Kino print was not as good as what... and a friend of mine has seen Blind Chance and recently saw the Criterion, and he said it was apples and oranges.
Nice.
So yeah, I'm looking forward to any Kieslowski, and I haven't seen a lot of those early films.
Yeah, I haven't either. I've only seen... I've seen Blind Chance and Camera... Well, I guess the only two I haven't seen is No End and The Scar, so excited for that. So, and there may be a film that's going out of print, Aaron?
Yeah, Fireman's Ball, Milos Forman, which is the Czech, the very satirical Czech political movie that was very controversial and really brought him to the States. It went out of print, and so a lot of times that means that it could be coming to Criterion as an upgrade. It came out on Arrow, along with Closely Watched Trains, which in the UK they call it Closely Observed Trains. So it could be coming, could not be coming, but I think it's interesting. I'm not going to buy the out of print, just in case.
Did Arrow do Loves of a Blonde? I can't remember right now.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. That's probably my favorite of his early Czech stuff, but now I'm tempted, but maybe I'll hold off, Aaron. Like you say, maybe it's coming somewhere else.
Yeah, maybe a box set would be pretty cool.
We should mention, too, I don't think the website doesn't show it as out of print, but from what DVD List said, it says discontinued. So,
right, yeah. Thank you. To credit DVD List. So we'll see if that's firm.
And I'm a out of print completist, so I sometimes sit there with my finger on the buy button, like, should I buy it? Shouldn't I? I pulled the trigger, so we'll see.
Okay.
So, this next piece of news comes from just a little blip that said, and some other things, but there was a post on Facebook from the Criterion Collection, of course, and when it comes from the Coen brothers, we have to talk about it. So briefly, there was showing the picture of them at the Criterion Collection, and they came in with T-Bone Burnett last week to talk about Inside Llewyn Davis, and then it says, in parentheses, and some other things. So,
mm-hmm. I know. Yeah, I saw that too. What other things? I can think of a dozen other things I would love.
Would love to speculate.
Barton Fink was, I don't know if it was rumored or confirmed at some point or teased. I can't remember the specifics, and I'm sure somebody will point it out. But Barton Fink, it seems like a great fit for the collection, but never happened. Who knows? We may never know. It might have been rights, or maybe it's still in the works.
Right.
Maybe it's materials. Who knows?
Go ahead, Brian.
Is that a Fox title? I'm trying to remember. I think Barton's a Fox title.
Could be. I don't think there's a Blu-ray, though.
No, there's definitely not.
There is. So. It's in the box set. I can't think of what it is. It's got four films in it.
There's one box set that doesn't have that.
You know what? My mistake. I'll correct myself. I'm thinking of I have the Blu-ray box set from the UK, so it's available on Blu-ray from the UK.
That's even more. The plot thickens.
There's a little box set and includes Barton Fink, some of the later stuff like A Serious Man. It has the Big Lebowski in it too. I was thinking of the four set that I can't think of the name of it that has the early stuff like Raising Arizona. Fargo,
Miller's Crossing.
And Miller's Crossing. Those are the four.
I have that set. And that one's like those Criterions. It's just a slipcase with the four discs.
Right.
Since we got Llewyn Davis, I think A Serious Man, even though it has a Blu-ray, that seems like a fit for Criterion.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? I think that could be coming out.
That'd be great.
I would love it to come out. And, of course, The Big Lebowski. Although I don't think any studio is going to let Criterion have the Big Lebowski, so
right, yeah. I'm sure
it's got to be such a cash cow.
Yeah. Well, my copy of the Big Lebowski is still DVD, but it's an actual bowling ball. It's a great release.
Back in my video store days, we used to go to the bowling alley they filmed Lebowski at, and we'd bowl there every Sunday for about 3 months.
That's awesome.
It's closed now, sadly. I think it's a school or something, but we would go there, and you could still see some of the signage up, from the movie, and it was our temple. It was our temple.
Yeah.
So
great.
Did anybody, quote Jesus?
I'm sure the
character Jesus.
Yeah. I'm sure we did all the time. You couldn't help it,
Oh, that's awesome.
They still had the time to bowl clock, I think, and it was great.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Very cool.
Yeah, big fan.
So, almost lastly, unfortunately, we have some sad news. I don't know what it is with the founders of boutique labels this year, but we had the passing of Ron Benson, Aaron.
Yeah, and just a few weeks after William Becker, and this is Ron Benson is the founder of Eureka Entertainment, and if you don't know, that's Masters of Cinema, so that's, again, peripherally involved with the Criterion Collection.
Right.
But they do great work, and I think all three of us are collectors or consumers. So so that's a big hit for Masters of Cinema. And yeah, because it's in the UK and because it's there's I do read a lot of UK video things, but I don't know, you know, a whole lot about Ron Benson, and I think I probably will know far less about him than William Becker, but it looks like he had quite a legacy. And I'll put the Facebook post that Eureka put out about Ron in the show notes. And another good one lost. Sympathies to everybody at Eureka and Masters of Cinema.
Yeah, sad to see that. So lastly for our news, just wanted to mention this coming Tuesday is, it's kind of a big title, don't you think?
For yes,
Mr. Lynch. For sure.
Yes.
The 2001 film Mulholland Drive is coming out Tuesday, so very excited for that. And I guess we'll have to talk about it next week.
I'm going to stalk my mailman on Tuesday. I'm going to chase after him.
So did you guys, I'm just curious, did you guys both order it, or either of you waiting for the sale?
We're ordering it.
We're
casting it, so we kind of have to watch it.
Makes
but,
sense. I couldn't wait either. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to get it.
Yeah.
And the packaging looks great, so we can't wait. And we were talking about the way we're going to do our cast next week, and at first we thought we'll do a subtopic on David Lynch. But you know what? We're going to double down. We're going to do more Mulholland Drive. And I'm sure we'll bring in David Lynch's films, and I'm sure we'll talk at length about them. And we have a mystery guest, so...
Ooh, excited.
More to come on that.
More to come, yeah.
So that's it for our news segment. So we're going to go ahead and get into The Brood from David Cronenberg is next. Welcome back to Criterion Close-Up, Episode 12, everyone. We are here with Aaron West and Brian Sauer, and we're going to get into a David Cronenberg film from 1979, The Brood.
The Brood.
This was recently released by Criterion. It is spine number 777 from 1979. And the synopsis is, this is what IMDb says. A man tries to uncover an unconventional psychologist's therapy techniques on his institutionalized wife with a series of brutal attacks committed by a brood of mutant children coincides with the husband's investigation. So if that doesn't sound like a Cronenberg film, I don't know what does. So... This is a director-approved edition. I always love to see that. I think all of the Cronenberg ones are. He always has his hand in the release from Criterion. The main actors are Oliver Reed, Samantha Egger, and Art Hintle. Also, Cindy Hines as a young Candace Carveth. Didn't see much else from her, so glad to see her there. And should mention, this is actually based a little bit on Cronenberg's own experience with his wife, abducting his daughter early on. So it's kind of an interesting tie-in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And I think he actually had to, didn't he have to retrieve his daughter from a cult in California or something?
He did.
Yeah, that's what I hear, yeah.
That's the story.
It's bizarre.
Yeah.
I love that it made this movie become a thing.
I know.
But it sounds like a terrible experience. And I know he's always called this movie his Kramer versus Kramer,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is... always kind of amused me, but the more I watch it, and I think he says something like, it's my Kramer versus Kramer, and it's more realistic than that movie. I don't know, something like that.
Yeah, well, that's something. And, you know, you kind of wonder if it was maybe a little cathartic for him to process, you know, whatever he was going through. And I think there are a lot of directors and writers that have done that, written about themselves and put it down in film, and who knows, maybe that's his therapy.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, certainly.
Maybe that's his psychoplasmics.
and we wanted to mention too, I mean, we have a pretty strict spoiler policy on the show, and we will stay out of spoilers, but we will have to touch on the final scene, and we'll announce that as we when we get into that.
Yeah, we might have to go even further. This is a tough movie to talk about without getting into like what the psychology, how that leads, and then how that culminates at the end. So
yeah, that last Oliver Reed scene is one of my favorite things, and I don't know how we would talk about it.
Yeah,
really.
I think we'll warn. Sound good? We'll warn, and I think we'll maybe play the clip, and maybe we'll see when we get there.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about, I guess we should start with the actors, and we'll get into some of the themes of the film. So I wanted to kick it to you guys to see what you thought about some of the acting. I think we, as Cronenberg goes through his career, we'll talk about it a little bit more later, but he does add some more heavyweight actors to his cast. So, of course, mm-hmm. we have Oliver Reed and Samantha Egger and Art Hintel, I wasn't really familiar with. But what did you guys think of
it? It's Hintel, by the way.
Hintel. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Again, Art. It's the brain and the mouth not working together.
I don't care, but Art might.
Yes. listens. Mr. Carbeth. So, yeah, so looking at the actors, we've got Oliver Reed, Samantha Egger, Art Hintel, and of course some others. And so I think with the acting, he kind of starts to add some more heavyweights to his repertoire. So Aaron, what did you think about the acting in this film?
It's definitely a cut above, and we're going to get to the later Cronenbergs in the next segment. But Oliver Reed, I love that man. He's just tremendous. And not just his act. I mean, he's a tremendous actor. And he brings kind of a theatrical presence, too. You know, you can even see by the way his movements on the screen, they're very, you know, theatrical, grandiose. And he speaks, you know, you can see he projects his voice in a way. And as a psychologist for this sort of demonic, cultish philosophy, it actually fits, you can't extricate what's on screen with the guy we know off screen, who is this warped drunk. And mm-hmm. There's a supplement with him. I'm going to put some clips in the notes with him on other talk shows. The guy was just a character, something else. But he could bring it. He could act. And Egger was great too. I think, you know, the pivotal scenes and even the earlier scenes as she's processing.
Yeah.
And I was surprised to find on the features that she was only on set for 4 days.
Yeah.
That's a lot of good acting for 4 days. What do you think, Brian?
It's a perfect sort of showcase for Oliver Reed. Like you were saying, we can get into the specifics of the plot, but because a lot of it is him as the psychologist role playing, it's very theatrical. And he just sort of has an opportunity to play sort of different characters. I don't know when we want to talk about psychoplasmics and what it is, but that sort of plays into his performance because, I mean, a lot of it has to do with, you know, him playing different roles in the person's life that he's dealing with. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll get to the science, but he's intense,
it's a great,
and conniving. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, but he's just allowed to change characters mid-scene, and it's just an interesting opportunity for an actor as good as him to play different roles within the same role, kind of.
Oh, you mean in the therapy? And maybe this is a good opportunity to play that opening therapy clip. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, it's a good idea.
Let's go ahead and play that.
You're not looking at me in the eyes. That's weak. Only weak people do that.
I could look you in the eye if I wanted to, Daddy. I just don't want to look you in the eye.
I guess you're just a weak person. Hmm? You must have got that from your mother. It probably would have been better for you had you been born a girl. Then we could have named you Michelle. Hmm? You see, weakness is more acceptable in a girl, Michelle. Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, Mike.
Yeah, intense. I would not want to be Michael in that scene.
No. Brutal.
Yeah. No, he does a great job with that. I mean, he's playing the characters that are really feeding into the what's causing problems for his patients, and some role playing there, I should say. Some of his acting style with this too reminds me of the Geico commercial where they you've got the golfers, and it talks about how the announcers are always whispering, and Oliver's kind of, you know, always whispering throughout this performance. It's just, you know, understated, but he's, you know, projecting, like you said, Aaron. I really liked his performance.
Yeah, he does whisper, but it doesn't sound quiet because he's so intense and focused, and his words are so biting. It's definitely the best performance, I think, up until that period of Cronenberg's filmography. I think it might be one of the best. Well, we're not, this isn't part of the show, but I think the best Cronenberg performance is Ralph Fiennes in Spider. So
there you go.
Reed is up there.
Nice.
And Edgar is great too.
Yeah, she's really good. She was a kind of a surprise for me. I thought she was, you know, in her 4 days there, you just get the sense that there is something is not right there, and the way that she's kind of working through this is pretty amazing. So let's talk. We were going to talk some about the science of this too, of course, and made up word, but the kind of therapy that the Oliver Reed Ragland puts out is called Psychoplasmics. And he has a book that's called, I believe it's called The Look of Rage, that you mm-hmm. see a couple of times throughout it. And so that's the name of his treatment. And, you know, again, we won't spoil it yet, but there are some pieces that we can talk about later. But, you know, there's a quote within the movie that says, you know, more time with Ragland and you'll be charging him for psychological damage too. There's a character within the movie that, you know, that's,
yeah,
things start to unravel as, during that scene. Maybe that's a good time to play that scene too. I think,
are you talking about the patient and, the cancer? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's it's a smaller part, but that's a good performance. And,
oh yeah, I like that guy a lot.
And he's sweating, and you can actually hear, and here we'll play the clip, and you can hear how he's kind of disheveled and beaten down. So we'll go ahead and play that now.
So, Mr. Carvath, how'd you get my name?
Oh, my lawyer knows your lawyer.
Oh, I see. I get it. Is your lawyer preparing a case against Ragland too?
Basically, yes. Slightly different from yours.
Yeah? How different?
Well, my wife is still in therapy with Ragland. I'm claiming psychological damage, not physiological.
Oh, I see. Well, give him some more time with your wife, and you'll be able to claim physiological damage too. Wouldn't this look impressive in court? Do you like it? I do. That's Ragland. That's Psychoplasmics. It's called lymphosarcoma. And it's spreading. It's a form of cancer of the lymphatic system.
You blame Ragland for that?
Oh, Ragland did it.
And he, what you can't see in that clip is he has, what would you call it, on his neck?
They call it crazy. It's well, it's got something. Was it called lymphosarcoma? I don't know if I'm saying that right. It was brought out from the lymphatic system. Of course, he's talking about. I mean, this is very Cronenbergish, right? Where Cronenberg will pick something from physiology and you know, bring it into the psychology, I guess, and he'll kind of bring it out, and you do see a manifestation there of that. And
it's
so
like
he'll focus on it.
It's like his lymph nodes kind of exploded outwardly.
Right.
I mean, seriously, I think that's what they're saying happened.
It's a truly Cronenbergian growth on his neck. When you see it.
And it's probably all plastic. But
yeah.
Right.
It's a good scene, And I think we'll get into more how Cronenberg interacts with science later, but I do think that it's interesting how, you know, there is a physiological and biological consequence of this philosophy or psychology. But did you feel that they really connected the two?
Well, that's for me, there's a question I had on this viewing, and again, I don't want to get too spoilery, but the therapy itself seems to cause physiological reactions in people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I couldn't tell if Ragland was targeting people that had this inclination to have physiological reactions.
I had the same
question, you know, because they touch on it later that Samantha Eggers' character had some evidence of this kind of thing earlier in her life. And I wonder if some of the other people he's treating at his little commune, I guess, had the same, like as if they were like mutants, you know, people that he found that had this response to his therapy that could prove that it could do something. So anyway, that's a inside baseball kind of a thing. You have to have kind of seen the movie.
Yeah.
But I had that question this time, so I don't know how he connected it.
Well, the girl had had bumps, and he thought that she was being abused, and everybody had some sort of physical manifestation of the I guess as a relation or as a consequence of the psychology. So,
right. Yeah, but, and you wonder, like Brian said, you know, is it something that he was aware of early on, or is it something that's brought out because of the, you know, the therapy? I wonder. I had the same thought.
And as we dig deeper, I think the actual arc of the film doesn't go in the direction of the cancer. It goes in the direction of the emotions. So
right. The psychology and yeah.
So even though I did like that they had that sort of physiological basis, it didn't really seem to, you know, lead anywhere. It kind of seemed like a red herring a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, talking about the personal part of it, I think really that's what makes this film richer and one of my favorite early Cronenberg. I mean, on a rewatch, this has become one that I appreciated that much more. I would just say early on, it didn't really connect with me as much. It just seemed like another Cronenberg film with some family aspects and, the medical aspects. But I think, you know, this one is rooted in a family, their dynamic, and I think you see the dynamic of all of the players. You know, you've got the two grandparents, the mother and father, and the daughter, and how this is a complete relationship and really a complete breakdown with each character.
Mm-hmm. And
absolutely,
yeah. And it's kind of a borderline spoiler, but the anger and that comes out in the therapy does come. Materialize in the physical world and breaks up that relationship. And yeah, I'm kind of biting my tongue here. but even like the first third of the film, the first appearance of what the namesake, the Brood, is a consequence of the therapy and of what's going on between Oliver Reed and Samantha Eggar. Maybe I should play the. I have to be careful because there's a lot of profanity and we're trying to keep a clean cast, but maybe I should play the Samantha Eggar clip and then say that what happens there has some consequences.
Sure.
You didn't protect me. You didn't. You didn't, you didn't, you didn't, and you should have. You should have. You shouldn't have looked away when she hit me. And you shouldn't have walked away from the table when she twisted my words. You should have stopped her. You should have hit her when she hit me, and you should have slapped her when she slapped me. Oh, God, I love you.
I think, talking about the family, too, I mean, aspects of it, some kind of inklings to what's going on. Of course, we see the grandmother drinking and the grandfather drinking, and you also I like the kind of the dynamic with Frank, the father, which is Candace's father, where he's saying that Nola married me for my sanity. So he's really kind of the brought in from the outside of the family. He doesn't have any of these manifestations, so to speak, and so he's kind of the sane one trying to figure out what's going on and really just trying to protect his family, especially his daughter.
Daddy and a detective at the same time, sort of.
Right.
So. Well, I was going to say, this is my first rewatch since I've had my own daughter. So that was an interesting perspective shift for me. I still don't totally connect to Art Hindle's performance or his character.
Agreed.
Because he's just, I don't know, emotionally, he doesn't respond quite the way that I would. He's just very, it's just sort of his personality. Like you said, Mark, it's the sanity part. He plays that and it ends up either playing his character a little flat, like I said, or something. But,
yeah. He's kind of milk toast. Yeah.
Yeah.
A little bit. I mean, he's fine, but, the others are much more, and the story are much more interesting to me, but yeah, it's interesting to sort of see it from that perspective. You know, that's one of the things I love about coming back to films that have something like this later in life. It's just a totally different thing.
Yeah, it's a great point, Brian. It's one to revisit. I mean, for me, I had just seen this within the past year, and even rewatching it that time did connect more. And I think if as your life changes, I mean, you could actually connect with different characters. I mean, geez, if you were a grandfather or mother, you could. Grandmother, you could connect like with a grandfather coming back saying, I'm sorry, it's just kind of a vicious cycle it seems like we're in this family. So yeah, really appreciated that.
And on the other side of the coin, as the only person on this cast that doesn't have kids, I'm never having them now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But back to Hendel, you know, I kind of thought that his character was kind of just like an exposition magnet. You know, he just existed really to set things in motion and to... So, yeah, I thought he was the weakest of the bunch. And I think Cronenberg, and again, we'll get to this in the third segment, but he does tend to have weak leads, I think. Hmm. Would you agree?
Yeah.
Especially in this earlier stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I think up till Scanners, and including Scanners, but, you know, the supporting characters, I think, are a lot more engaging.
Yeah, more interesting, yeah. For sure.
Hmm. True.
It's definitely the case here that...
So why don't we get into the villains a little bit? I mean, I think we've got to talk about the Brood itself a little bit. So I guess I'll kick it to Brian. What did you think about the Brood itself? Were they frightening? I
mean, yeah. Well, I mean, that was the draw for me from the get-go was okay. Just how creepy they look. And I don't know how much they scare you guys. But when I first saw this movie, and I saw it a long time ago, they freaked me out. Hmm. You know, they're just, you know... And the way that they sort of, he teases them before they appear, mm-hmm. It got me. I don't know. What do you guys think?
They're scary, but yeah, I mean, kind of comically so.
Yeah, they might be.
A little bit now, and I don't want to be politically incorrect. You know, yeah, mm-hmm. I didn't think of them as little people. I thought of them more as children, and I think that's part of the horror is that mm-hmm. and seeing the one scene where they're. They go into the classroom. Actually, that was one of the scariest Brood scenes I saw. And you guys, as fathers, probably, you know, your kids are in schools, so that's probably even more frightening to you because it hits you on that level.
Yeah, my wife's a teacher, too. So.
Oh, wow. Oh, there mine, you go. Too. Wow.
So dual.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that was by far the scariest. I mean, really, the two scenes that stood out for me are the scenes where they're walking with Candace on the road and then, yeah, the school mixing with the other children. I mean, you could draw a parallel with, you know, a lot of the school shootings that we've had. You know, when you talk about how frightened you are of sending your kids to school and then you see a mm-hmm. film like this where, you know, something like that happens, definitely was scary.
And, you know, the way, and I don't think this is a spoiler, but the way they harm people is not with weapons or guns, or it's blunt force trauma. They just beat people down, and that's frightening.
Beating and biting and just, yeah, it's just so primal.
And maybe I should play the first death clip, and I don't think this is a spoiler, but it's really just a lot of sound effects, and you can hear the destruction that just one person in the Brood, actually this is the one that the child witnesses.
Right.
I'll go ahead and play that now. Yeah, I'm not going to tell you who died there or why, but it sounds scary, don't you think?
Yeah, well, I was thinking about that. I like the way that Cronenberg uses sound to kind of introduce what's going on. I mean, there's a, you know, inherent horror there, mm-hmm. but also, you know, later during another scene, you hear the sound as the Brood is leaving of a mm-hmm. broken window. So it's kind of that, you know, intro, entry, or exit kind of sound. I really like the way that that's handled.
And the score is fantastic, too. And it's everywhere. So Howard Shore, was it? Did it?
Yeah. That's something interesting. I mean, I'm glad you brought him up. He is a... maybe I'll talk about him a little bit more later when we talk about Cronenberg, but he's a staple. I mean, he's been mm-hmm. with Cronenberg through his entire career, and I really like his work. I mean, people know him from, like, Lord of the Rings, so...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
good stuff. I wanted to mention too, one thing that really stuck with me regarding the Brood was I liked that specimen scene and how it's, you know, all colored in purple. So I don't think this is too spoilery. The thing I wanted to mention was, you know, the scene where they're talking about how the Brood sees only in black and white. And, you know, I think that's obviously a tie in to, you know, how some people see things in black and white, and, you know, and the fact that they drained most of the color except for purple out of that scene, I think is telling. I mean, that's obviously something, you know, Cronenberg was playing with a bit.
All right, Mark, I can't help it. We have to go to spoilers.
Here we
go. How about this? What I'll do is I'll play a little clip of music, and if you don't want to hear the spoilers, just look in the show notes to the next segment and skip ahead. But let's go.
All right.
All right. Well, the big spoiler is the Brood, who I'm sorry, I'm calling them the Teletubbies.
You can't help but not.
Yeah. I can't help it, and I kind of wonder, you know, if
it could be.
You wonder, the Brood, they are motivated by the anger of Samantha Eggers' character, and so in that scene that we heard a moment ago, they kill the grandmother because she is talking about how terrible a mother her mother was to Oliver Reed. And yeah, the idea that emotions can have actual physical, real world, I keep using the word consequences, but repercussions.
Yeah, it's
manifestations.
You know, you think about how, I mean, every day we hear about people. My wife watches Dateline, and every one of those shows is really about that. You know, about how you hurt the ones that you love, and that's, you know, this is a, you know, it's what Cronenberg does. He really takes an idea and really runs with it from the kind of horrific and, you know, a scientific, medical, whatever you want to call it, offshoot, and, you know, gives it something you can look at and really be afraid of.
And I think this is the most interesting premise. And I should also say that if I were in this therapy, if I were in Psychoplasmics, my Teletubbies would juggle for you, Mark.
Oh, that's great. I can almost picture those, too. That's crazy.
They would come over with smiles on their face. Oh, Mark's awesome. Sorry. I thought they were great, but you can't help but laugh a little bit. I don't know if you saw it as I was watching. I tweeted a little bit some funny things. But,
they're still
horrifying
stuff.
And funny at the same time.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, what did you think of the you know, some of the ending scenes there, Brian?
That's some of my favorite stuff. Yeah. I mean, the scene where Oliver Reed is trying to retrieve Candy from the shed, and it cross cuts between Art Hindle and Samantha Egger talking, and her getting more and more agitated.
Yes,
it's just one of my favorite things. I just think it's such a great, you know, you see this reaction like as she starts to get upset. How they're starting to jump all over Oliver Reed. I don't know. This is just a great scene to see all these Teletubbies jump all over Oliver Reed.
Yeah, right. I mean, you don't see that.
Yeah.
You don't see that otherwise. You don't see the cross-cutting. You know, in the other scenes, you just see the, you know, it's kind of the, like I said, the sound and then the, you know, the horror, the violence. But yeah, here you see the how she's really affecting them. You do see it a little bit where she kind of wakes up, where, you know, Oliver Raglan comes in and wakes her up, and, you know, she talks about the dream that she had, and she's not concerned about the teacher anymore because, of course, the teacher's dead.
Right.
So, yeah.
That's one way to handle it, yeah. maybe we should play her speech at the end, and I'll have to do some creative editing with the speech because of the cross-cutting. I don't think that'll work as well in audio, but Samantha Egger in that final scene... Man.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll go ahead and play it. So, spoiler alert.
Oh, God, Nola.
No, I disgust you. I sicken you. You hate me. You didn't come here because you love me. You came here to take our daughter away and give her to somebody else.
I wouldn't do that.
You're lying. You're lying! You're lying! I know!
And that doesn't have any licking or biting.
Yeah, I was going to say, you can't see the lick, which apparently from the special features, that was her choice.
It was her idea. Licking.
It's like a cat, yeah.
Inspired.
Yeah, oh, yeah. And it's. Have you guys seen Society?
No.
Yeah.
I kind of thought of that. I mean, this is not as crazy an ending as that.
No.
By any stretch.
That movie is off the charts. That movie's off the charts.
But it is, and the cover actually spoils the movie. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah, I don't dig that.
I'm not into that either. I like the cover, but
beautiful cover, but yeah, I liked in the special features how they talked about how they were concerned about. I mean, it's a small budget film. I think they filmed it in like 2 weeks, but that big frock that she's wearing, you know, they didn't want to get any blood on it because they didn't have enough money to have another one. So
I missed that. Yeah. That's...
Yeah.
It's just the low budget, Mark. It's really interesting what Cronenberg does with a low budget. You know, you've seen Corman and how that kind of school of thought, but he does a really interesting thing in that he makes so much of it psychological. And, but I mean, he spent money on the effects, obviously, as far as the brood goes, but just the locations and whatnot, he just really makes it feel bigger than it is, obviously.
That's a great point. And that ties into, I think, into, you know, what we're talking about with the early Cronenberg, how, you know, he makes... He really sets up something that is obviously has something to do with the medical world, but he makes it sometimes confined and sometimes bigger. You know, you kind of think about what could happen if this gets out. Ideas always underlying, you know, Cronenberg's film. So yeah, it's great. So why don't we kind of move into? I mean, I think we've anything else to say about the movie? I should say before we give our ratings.
Lots, but we need to move on.
Should probably move on.
Sure.
So
I think we ended up talking more about plot and curiosities than really digging into the emotion. I mean, there's so much you can mine in this one, but it's just we'd have to do.
Yeah. So Brian, so what we usually do, we give a film rating and we also give a Criterion rating and of course talk about canonizing this thing. So what film rating on a scale of 1 to 10 would you give The Brood?
It's a favorite of mine, so I mean I'd probably give it like a 9. You know, it's really up there for me. Big favorite.
Cool. How about you, Aaron?
I actually really dug it. I'd seen most of the Cronenbergs up until then, so I was expecting more of the same, and I was actually kind of surprised that Criterion announced The Brood. It's more cultish, more Arrow film kind of material, seems like. But I really got into it, and I was pleasantly surprised, so I'm going to give it an 8. So I think that's pretty. It's one of my favorite Cronenbergs for sure.
Nice, cool. Yeah, I mean, for me on initial watch, I was going like 6, and you know, for the show, I was probably going to go a 7, but I could really go for an 8 because I think again on a second viewing, it just really connected. I mean, really that second viewing, I'd probably give it a 9, but you know, I'll average it out and say 8. I should mention too, Roger Ebert gave this 1 star. So it's harsh.
Roger, I love Ebert, but he would react with vitriol against films he didn't like. We've already talked about that before, and I think if something offends him, what's weird is considering the movie he made, but if something offends him, he will lash out against it. So I kind of, and Pauline Kael was the same way.
So, and you know, regarding the supplements, this is a 2K restoration, of course, supervised by Cronenberg. It's uncompressed monaural soundtrack. It's not like a 5.1 or anything. There's a documentary about the making of the film and Cronenberg's early work that has Samantha Egger, executive producer, Pierre David, cinematographer, and some of the special effects artists. It also includes a 4K transfer of his second full-length feature, Crimes of the Future, from 1970. And that part of that is a 2011 interview with Cronenberg about his early career. It's called Cronenberg, the Early Years. Mm-hmm. Curious how The Brood only gets a 2K and Crimes of the Future gets 4K, but anyway.
Probably, maybe space, maybe money, I don't know.
Yeah, it's
or
weird.
Or maybe materials.
Yeah.
And then there is an interview with the actors Art Hindle and Cindy Hines. It's called Meet the Carveths. There's an appearance of Oliver Reed on the Merv Griffith Show from 1980. It has Charo and Orson Welles. And yeah, so I mean, that's really it for the supplements. What do you guys think?
That's probably the only Oliver Reed appearance that where they could put him on the disc and it not scare people away by how crazy he was and how drunk he was.
Yeah, I wonder if he was drunk on the show. It kind of looks like he might have been, but it was fun.
Probably.
He was drunk on the set. They mentioned it was the Heinz Hendel interview. They said he would start drinking in the afternoon and he would sneak away. So, yeah, he liked the bottle.
That was his thing.
No, that Merv Griffin is really interesting because of the interaction between he and Orson Welles.
It's great. I loved it.
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, Welles is really reserved and Oliver Reed seems like very on the defense a little bit, you know, like he's very sensitive. It's really interesting to see that, you know,
Yeah.
Orson Welles will interrupt him and he'll like get kind of annoyed with him. It's just, yeah. It's very funny.
Yeah. Interesting dynamic there.
They played off each other pretty well too. And actually, even though there was a weird dynamic, they had a mutual respect too, and I think they both complimented each other on that.
Yeah, episode. No, Welles gave him really high praise. Yeah. You know, like to call him, and he's and to, you know, fair enough. He is one of the greats. It's
true. Sure, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Even his last role, and I'm not a big film fan of Gladiator, but he was even good in that. And
yeah, absolutely.
Some of that was 100%. So,
yeah,
one of the legends for sure.
Yeah, I really liked how he was committed to this. And I have to just mention in my notes from The Brood how there was a Happy Days lunchbox, the tall one with the bumper clips there of sorts.
I love that.
Nice,
Did you guys have that one of those lunchboxes with the tall ones with the clips when you were growing up? I had
many.
Yeah.
Nice. Every time a new movie, E.T., Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I had Return of the Jedi. Right.
Nice.
I think I had that too.
Yeah, be remiss if we didn't mention that. So,
yeah, we'll have a lunchbox episode here. Yeah.
We should get a Criterion close-up lunchbox. Maybe, that's what we'll do.
Oh yeah,
sorry. Get one of those away. So,
go ahead.
Sorry, Aaron, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that I really liked the early years Cronenberg interview, and that's actually kind of hidden on the disc. I almost missed it because it's in the Crimes of the Future, but I liked how he talked about how his first two films were underground films, and I think we should skip those since we'll talk about them in the next segment.
Right.
And that he almost didn't get Shivers because of those two. And then I'm talking about how somebody reacted negatively against Shivers, and then and we'll get into that later. But I thought that was a great interview and very candid.
Yeah. Yeah, he's very engaging. Agreed. That is a good one.
Yeah, it's a little short, but it was really great to have on there. It's definitely one of my favorite supplements.
So, I mean, talking about supplements, what would you guys give this as a Criterion rating? You know, and with a Criterion rating, we think about the movie, the transfer, the audio, and the extras, on this Blu-ray. So, what do you think, Brian?
Would you guys mind going first? I'm trying to gauge how you guys do it. I'm just curious.
Sure. How about you, Aaron? Go ahead.
I liked it, and even though we'll talk about the movie later, I like any time they put a movie on the disc. So I'll give it a 9.
Nice. All right. I'm gonna go 8. I think with the video solid, the audio is good, the extras are good. There are some scenes with the well lit scenes have really good video. I think there are a few that lose definition, like when he's in the woods and it's darker, probably too much grain, and that may be part of the budget and just the inherent in the video itself, but. I wonder if maybe it's different sources that were used. I'm not sure what the transfer was, but looks pretty good. But I would say too, I always trust Criterion to bring us some of the best genre films, like they do with early Cronenberg and Lady Snowblood coming. So for me, I'd give it a solid 8 rating.
Okay.
I got you now. I figure this. I think. I'm somewhere between 8 and 9. I wish there was just a little bit more Cronenberg than that one interview.
And a commentary. I meant to mention, that would bump.
Yeah,
it up,
that would be great. I don't know how many. I'm trying to think of how many commentaries I've heard of him doing. It may not be his thing, but it'd be nice to have a little bit more from the man himself. Like, I'd love to hear the stories. Maybe he doesn't want to talk about it, but like the personal connection to the movie. I'd love to hear him go on at length about that. So that's one thing, but no, I'm with you, Aaron, 100%. It's always nice when they include an early film. That's pretty neat. So yeah, somewhere between 8 and 9, I think, for me.
Yeah, I would have taken a commentary with just Oliver Reed stories.
Right.
Me too. That'd be
Oliver
great.
Reed commentary or something. I think he did one for Videodrome, if I remember. It was like 2 commentaries on that. So
really?
Oh, cool.
And I guess since he's nobody, they wouldn't do a critical commentary, you know, since Cronenberg's still in the game. So
right.
It's really up to him.
So how about canonizing this thing? Is this thing on the website Criterion Blues, there is a list of films that have been canonized, many by Aaron, some by us on the podcast. Would you canonize this thing, Aaron?
Nah, sorry. I really like it. And it's great horror, but no, it's not. It doesn't belong with like Ozu. So
right. I'd go there too. Now, Brian, for our canon or your personal canon, would you canonize this thing?
Personally, yes. I can see how you you maybe. Might leave it out out of the Ozu conversation. That makes sense. Right. But personally, I think it's one of the better horror films in the 1970s. That's just my own take.
I agree with that, and I think it is a very strong horror film. I don't quite elevate it to there. There are a couple, like maybe Suspiria, I might put in the canon. Maybe Black Christmas. So some I like. Maybe Texas Chainsaw. So.
Yeah. Yeah, we might talk about those a little later. I've got a few I would canonize, but yeah, I'm with you. I wouldn't quite put this in the canon, but you know, as far as if you had a Cronenberg canon, it might go in there. If you're going to canonize something from the early stuff, this might be the one. So,
or a Teletubby canon.
Sorry, I'm going to have dreams about evil Teletubbies tonight. Thanks, Aaron.
Sorry, guys. It's you got to have a little fun.
That's great. Well, that is David Cronenberg's The Brood. So as we mentioned before, we're going to get into early Cronenberg from the 1970s in our next segment. So we'll be right back with you.
To take Candace away from her at this stage could send Lola over into the deep end. It's a critical time for her, Frank.
Yeah, well, I happen to think that Nola's been in over her head for a long time now.
You have no legal right to deny access.
Any time you'd like to test the matter in open court, I'd be more than happy to oblige.
For the ultimate good of your own family, Frank, we'd be prepared to do just that. But don't you force it.
And welcome back, everyone, to Criterion Close Up. This is our final segment where we are talking about some early Cronenberg films. So we're going to talk about movies from his 1970s work, although we'll also throw in 1969's Stereo. And folks are familiar with David Cronenberg. I mean, he's been working for quite some time, and he's got, I mean, his last film was from 2014 in Maps to the Stars. And so, you know, we're really going to be talking more about those body horror films of his early career. I mean, not to talk too much about him overall as a career, but, you know, I mentioned the body horror of the early ones. You get some more of that with, you know, The Fly and Videodrome, of course, in the 1980s. And, you know, of course, we've got Dead Ringers and The Dead Zone there, a little bit more kind of psychological and mental, I guess you could say. And he gets into some crazy stuff with Crash and what I thought was, I mean, I need to revisit Existence. That's kind of a bit, it's interesting to me how that came out the same year as The Matrix. And of course, we have some later films.
Naked Lunch.
Naked Lunch, yes, thank you. I almost missed that one. Also from Criterion. And, you know, I wonder if we'd see something like Crash maybe from Criterion, although that's probably more of an Arrow title. And then, and finally, you know, he's got some of his later films like A History of Violence, Eastern Promises with Viggo Mortensen, Cosmopolis, and so some pretty varied career, I think. But again, we're gonna focus on his early work, more of the body horror stuff that he's known for. So, any comments, guys, on kind of his career overall, or this early stuff before we kind of get into the movies themselves?
Well, I did notice when I was looking at his career that it does divide pretty neatly by decade. You know, his 70s is body horror, and then the 80s you had The Fly and Scanners. It's still horror, but it was taken on a new, more mainstream direction.
Sure.
And then the 90s, you know, he started getting more artistic, and then the aughts, you know, he had more, still artistic, but a little bit of like, I don't want to use the word Oscar bait, but like, you know, History of Violence is he probably, the 70s version of Cronenberg probably couldn't see himself making a history of violence.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, dangerous method. Yeah, for sure.
Eastern Promises. Yeah, so.
Yeah, anything to say there, Brian? Any favorites that you have maybe outside of the decade before we get into the 70s?
I like the 70s and 80s stuff the most. The more recent stuff has been a bit of a disappointment for me. I mean, I like History of Violence a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. But it seems to have gone away from creating his own material in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And
yeah, he doesn't write his own stuff anymore.
I'm with you, Brian.
Yeah,
so it just doesn't have quite the same Cronenberg feel, you know, and I miss that.
Yeah,
the last few I have not been a fan of at all, so that's unfortunate.
Yeah, I really want to rewatch Cosmopolis because I liked it at first, but it just kind of, I found it really hard to kind of delve into and deconstruct. So I think that's certainly could be a grower, as we say on the show.
Mm-hmm. I feel the same way, Mark.
Yeah.
The first decade and the first three decades, I think, were really strong. So
yeah,
and he's been working a long time. Wow.
Yeah. So let's get into it. I mean, we talked about how his early film, 1969 Stereo, is featured on the Criterion version of Scanners, and then we've got in 1970 Crimes of the Future. Again, these are both about an hour long. Crimes of the Future is, of course, on The Brood, and I didn't get a chance to see Stereo, but I understand you did, Aaron. What'd you think?
Yeah, I saw it. I watched it at least. It was on the TV in front of my eyeballs. I'll get it that much.
That's a ringing endorsement, Aaron.
Yeah.
I think we'll find this with the first two films is they are, you definitely get a sense what he's going for, and Stereo is black and white, and there's not much sound. Actually, it's almost silent, really. There's no direct sound, and there's a lot of voiceover. There are a couple interesting visual things. And again, it's the recurring theme with his work is science. There's a telepathic dependency is what they, it's like people get addicted to being telepathic with each other.
Oh.
And that manifests with sexuality. So they sort of have this telepathic sexuality, and there is a good bit of nudity. So that would become very, very constant in his 70s
sexuality and nudity in a Cronenberg film. Interesting.
Yeah. But it's used in weird ways. So it's very, very quiet, very distant film. I didn't like it, but I would never watched it if it hadn't been for Cronenberg.
Right.
But in a way, I'm kind of glad I saw it just to kind of like, tie up the ribbon of his 70s career and see what he's up to. So
yeah, I mean, so how did that tie into Crimes of the Future for you? I mean, what'd you think of that? Same, it was on the TV, your eyeballs took it in.
Yeah, Crimes of the Future was tougher to watch. I would say I engaged a little more with Stereo, but I engaged very little at all. What I kept on thinking about with Crimes of the Future was Primer. Have you guys seen Shane Carruth's Primer?
I had the same thought. Yep,
love it.
Me too, yeah. And I really engaged with Primer. And I think they were going for that, but it just did not connect at all with me. And so I didn't engage at all. So.
Yeah. And I know, Brian, you weren't able to catch the whole thing, but any thoughts on what you saw, how it connected with you?
I mean, you can see the voice of a filmmaker there that's distinct. Mm-hmm. But, it came off a little pretentious for me, a little tough.
Yeah, I probably liked it the best of the three of us, and that's not to say that I really enjoyed it, but I certainly, think of it, like you said, Aaron, I mean, the aesthetic of it, the way that it's shot and it's just minimalistic, you can't help but think about Primer, but really a lesser film. I did like, I mean, you should mention it's a silent movie except for voiceover and really some discordant, really strange noises that I thought sometimes were kind of annoying, but I think, it's trying to disquiet the audience, I guess. Sometimes it sounds like a bee buzzing that may just be distorted voices. So, I thought that was interesting. The camera was a little distracting once in a while. Like there's an overhead shot that seems like it's just put there to be, an overhead shot. And I did think of, the noises a little bit like a couple times, like Under the Skin. I bring up that movie a lot, but, you could see how
I could see that. Yeah.
Maybe it was there. And I did, there were a couple shots, I'm not going to mention it, but I thought there's a kind of, as we get into the ending, there's a shot where my heart just kind of sank. And there is a shot of, you know, someone looking into the camera, kind of implicating the audience a little bit. So a little bit of a Children of Men vibe too, I guess, from a story point maybe, which I did appreciate. And, you know, really the use of cosmetics. I mean, I think it's most Cronenberg films early on are a cautionary tale of what we do, whether it's, you know, psychology, using of medications, using of cosmetics. So I did appreciate that. So interesting idea, but
did you know what happened?
No.
I mean, I had to look at IMDb and I was like, oh, that was it.
Right. It's nice that they put that out there. I think, yeah, IMDb has the synopsis and thank goodness.
Hey, so. IMDb got more than I did from it. So
that's right. So, and it could just be someone's interpretation, but yeah, I mean, I like how Cronenberg, he kind of tells a medical body horror story. It starts, you know, with some kind of experimentation and then just grows larger into a kind of a larger geographic area. And, you know, sometimes it may affect the world. But, you know, we're going to talk about, like, let's talk about one that kind of stays small, maybe not, in 1975's Shivers. So this is a film about the residents of a suburban high-rise apartment building are being infected by a strain of parasites that turn them into mindless, sex-crazed fiends out to infect others by the slightest sexual contact. So there's the sex aspect again. With
cannot forget the sex.
So have you both seen this one?
Yes.
Cool. Yeah. So start with you, Brian. What do you think of Shivers? It's his first, I guess I would say, more feature length, not really a mainstream film, but it was one that was made in 2 weeks for about $185K per the special features. It made $5 million. It was the first to make money for the Canadian Film Development Corporation. So I should mention too, this is just a setup. Cronenberg wanted to call it Orgy of the Blood Parasites, which I think is it's a fantastic title, and in the U.S. they called it They Came From Within. But what did you think, man? Brian,
I like it, but it's definitely, again, a filmmaker finding his voice kind of film, but it looks bigger than 185,000. I'll give him that for sure.
Definitely, yeah.
It's interesting. Like, it sets up a lot of the themes that he's gonna visit later in his career and throughout his career, and I like that about it. There's another movie called Demons 2, by Lumberto Bava, Mario Bava's son. This is much later, but it's also sort of a in an apartment building, people infected kind of thing, and I much prefer that movie to this.
Oh, okay.
I'll check that out.
I've heard of those two. I think Arrow has those, but I haven't.
Yeah,
they have
Demons and Demons 2. Synapse put them out too. I like both those movies a lot. But yeah, when I think of apartment building horror, I always think of Shivers and Demons 2. I do love the trailer for Shivers. They got the voiceover guy, Percy Rodriguez, who's the voice of the Jaws trailer that everybody knows, to do it, and I think that elevates material a lot.
Nice, that's cool.
I really like the commercial at the beginning of the film. I thought that was cut together pretty well, where they talk about the state of the art. Of course, today it doesn't look too impressive, but you know, for the 70s, it was shiny and looked like a very, I guess, tranquil place to live.
Yeah, I like this one quite a bit too. This is one of the early ones, probably the first 70s one that I saw before I saw, you know, like Scanners and those. But I did like it quite a bit. It did, of course, show the budget, but I love the you know, physical effects of films like this. I mean, of course, this is before CGI, so just really appreciate the, you know, how they did so much with a small budget and just created these really strange looking parasites. Made me afraid to. I haven't taken a bath since I've seen this movie. So. Just showers. Well, so
yeah.
Speaking of baths, I really like that Barbara Steele is in it. Barbara Steele is amazing. One of my favorites.
Nice. Okay. Cool.
Yeah, I don't think we have the equipment to really worry about that, Mark.
All right, good point, yeah. So, Aaron, what did you think about Shivers?
I also didn't know it was $185,000. I agree with Brian that you see a lot more. But I do agree that it was more in the direction of the science and the cautionary tale. One line that I picked up between the two doctors was, why not breed a parasite that can take on the function of a human organ? Hmm. And so I think we really see Cronenberg is trying to do the whole Oppenheimer nuclear bomb sort of analogy with science and medical science here and with his later work. And I do like engaging with that. That's not like a lot of other horror, and I know we'll get there. So, but of course it is, you know, the acting is not too spectacular.
Right.
The effects, even though they're cheap, I kind of enjoyed them. I thought they're fun. So I think it's more of a romp than a great film. But
sure. So. Yeah, I think that ties into, our next film, Rabbit, a little bit. This is from 1977. This is a young woman develops a taste for human blood after undergoing experimental plastic surgery. Here we go. There's always mm-hmm. some kind of aspect to it. And her victims turn into rabid, bloodthirsty zombies who proceed to infect others, which turns into a citywide epidemic. So in this case, it's citywide, not just a building. And I would, just to lead into it, I liked Shivers a little bit better. I think the special effects and kind of the body horror of it was more effective in Shivers. But I'll turn it to you, Brian. You've seen Rabbit, I believe. What did you think?
I like it, but I think, like you say, I might prefer Shivers. I think he, and when he comes back to the Brood, I think he just works well on an intimate scale and mm-hmm. in the early stuff, and I think that sort of is exemplified by Shivers, and the Brood is even more intimate than both of those films, so I think that's where he really finds his footing.
Yeah. I'm with you there, yeah.
Yeah, what did you think, Aaron, the Rabid?
Well, you said you haven't taken a bath since Shivers. I haven't worn deodorant since.
I thought I smelled something. Okay.
Oh, dear.
No, Rabbit, I think, is a step down from Shivers. It's okay. It's not one I'd watch if the Brood hadn't come out and the Dead Zone and Scanners and so forth. Again, I think it's a little interesting with the theme and the whole science and sexuality.
Right.
I'm not going to complain about the female body, but I thought he went a little too far.
Yeah, it wasn't quite. I mean, I should mention, too, it starred Marilyn Chambers, who was a porn star and a soap seller in her earlier career. Oh. So there's one scene, too, in Rabid that reminded me. I had rewatched Mad Max recently, and the scene with the motorcycle early on.
Oh, yeah.
Reminded me of the Mad Max crashes.
Oh, yeah.
And I was almost expecting the eyes to bug out like they do just before the crash in Mad Max, but... So
I think this movie needed a guitar player.
that would have been great. So, I would agree. I like the fact that each one of his movies are just a little bit different, a different take on what we do. Like this, in this case, it's experimental plastic surgery. I always want to keep a dictionary close to me, dictionary.com, because, when there's these words like psychoplasmics and, what is it? Morphogenetically neutral, is what the tissue does. So it's, that's Cronenberg. If you're into it, I mean, you can kind of get into it, and it's just that kind of, science that is, there's a word for it, but,
pseudoscience.
Yeah, pseudoscience, yeah. And kind of thinking about what could be. And I always find that stuff interesting.
What I'm curious about is, Cronenberg is definitely a smart guy, but I'm not a scientist. That's not my background. I kind of wonder if anybody who knows about science knows if there's if his theories are rooted in science reality.
Right.
Do you guys know?
Yeah, you're mentioning that. I mean, I honestly don't know, but it reminds me of Michael Crichton as a writer, how, he researches his topics, and he knows his stuff, but he constructs a story kind of around that idea. That's the parallel that I kind of see. But.
Yeah, I think if I were to wager, I'd say Crichton probably knows more than Cronenberg.
Yeah,
but.
I would agree.
Yep. It does seem to come from a more informed place from Cronenberg, although I don't know the specifics of his background. But when you hear him talk, it's you get a sense of a very intelligent guy that probably has some scientific, not research. I don't know what he does,
sure.
But it feels like a little grounded in something before it goes off crazy.
Right.
Kind of like the kid in science lab that is just really good at it and really gets into it. Almost like a science fanboy kind of.
Sure.
Yeah, certainly.
I definitely get that feeling from him. And science and sexuality.
Right, of course.
Two things, and they don't go together too well.
They usually don't. Well, and we have to mention, he did have another film that came out the same year as The Brood that has nothing to do with science, doesn't even, I would say, feel like a Cronenberg movie in Fast Company.
Or does it, Mark?
I don't know. I didn't see anything. What do you think?
Well, no. Have you seen this, Brian?
I think I have. It doesn't stand out in my memory too much.
Okay.
Well, it's about race cars.
Yeah.
And it's really about rival racing teams. And so it is more formulaic, mainstream. I guess two teams, two drivers, kind of fighting each other, or combating each other to be first. You know, if you've seen a racing movie, you've seen this one.
Yeah.
But I did, and I didn't like this. In fact, I think this was worse than Rabbit. The acting was atrocious. In fact, I kind of hated this, actually. but I did notice, first there's the sexuality. There's a lot of it, although it's not really tied to the plot. We know that Cronenberg's into cars, too, and he loves this film, which is kind of baffling to me. But he... they did focus on the technology behind the race cars and these funny cars, and they talked about the oil. So I did see a little bit of like a tech geek kind of basis there, and it did remind me a little bit that I could see that it was the same filmmaker, but you know, these cars didn't. This wasn't Christine,
right? Yeah, I think IMDb covered it really well because they said standard good guys versus bad guys drag racing movie. Nice scene of the driver's view during a funny car run. That's about all I took from it.
Yep.
It's a nice scene in there. I mean, they do actually have that one during the race where they show the view from inside the funny car. And I mean, mm-hmm. to me, that's what I enjoyed about it, because it's something, I'm not into racing, but I kind of got that view into this interesting part of racing where they're, you know, going to hundreds of miles per hour just over a quarter mile track. But you know, other than that.
I will say that I did like the way the race scenes were cut, and you could see during those scenes that was an auteur doing those, whereas the dialogue, you know, anytime that girl talked, I was out.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I think car racing movies wise, I recommend people see Jack Hill's movie Pit Stop, which is a similar story but much better.
It's on Arrow. Yeah.
Yep. Arrow release.
Right. Nice.
Arrow. Yeah. Yep.
Good stuff.
Check that one out if you're into the car racing movies. That's much better.
That's what, 69, I think it is?
Yeah, late 60s, yep.
Yeah.
So, good one.
So, I mean, within the 70s, we see a little bit of maturation of Cronenberg, I think. I mean, we come from 1969 Stereo to 79 Fast Company. We've talked a little bit about it, but you know, how do you feel Cronenberg matured as an artist throughout these films? I'll kick it to you first, Brian. Would you, think about this, you know, this early arc for him?
Well, I think it's interesting that In The Brood in 79, we talked about the personal nature of it and how that's where he seems to come into his own. So, mm-hmm. you know, starting Makes with sense. That in 79, he's using his own life to create this material and put his stamp on it. And then from there, I think he's got an incredible run of remarkable movies.
I think you're exactly right, yeah.
Finding the way to bring his own personal life into his twisted vision by the end of the 70s, I think, is quite beneficial. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah, people that write fiction are told to write what they know, and you know, I don't think he knew Psychoplasmics. I mean, he probably didn't know Rage Madness either, but you know, he's at least able to take a personal situation and develop a science around it. So, you know, I agree. I think, and what you said earlier, Brian, I think was spot on, is that he got more intimate with the characters, and I think Reed and Egger probably helped him. You know, just having two talented actors to really develop the material.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, is just, you know, deeper themes overall, and of course a bigger budget means better effects and better actors. So, you know, he's certainly you know, helped there.
Although I will give him credit, I think all of his 70s films, for the money they made, the effects are actually pretty good for how cheap they are. I've seen much worse.
I would agree. There's some really nice, I mean, folks should check out on The Brood some of the first special feature there includes some interviews with some of the early guys, and they talk about how, you know, Cronenberg would kind of, when they would show him a daily of one of the special effects, if he kind of raised his glasses and leaned in, that's when you knew you were in trouble, because mm-hmm. he's kind of looking at it closer. So yeah, mm-hmm. It's funny. He's a smart guy.
Yeah, and even though I didn't like Rabbit, I thought the effects were okay in Rabbit. I think the effects and his process were maturing, even if sometimes the films weren't. And actually, I think Fast Company was a well-put-together movie, just right. Not a good movie. So,
yeah. And so, you know, we should just briefly talk about, I mean, we did mention other 1970s horror staples and how this kind of fits into that. I mean, there are quite a few out there. Any that kind of come to mind that you would compare or, you know, that you like more or less than this film? Say, Brian.
I mean, Aaron mentioned a couple. I like Black Christmas a lot. I'm trying to think what are some of my other favorites.
Well, I'll mention...
Don't Look Now.
Yep.
Don't Look Now is great.
That's 73. The Exorcist came out in 73. I mean, that's personal favorite horror film. Just put that out there.
About that
Andy Warhol's, this is out of print from the collection, but we had Flesh for Frankenstein from them. Mm. The Wicker Man's the same year. Blood for Dracula was the next year. Death Dream in 74. Texas Chainsaw in 74. I mean, I was just looking at some of the, you know, mid-70s stuff. There's a lot of good 70s movies.
Yeah, Body Snatchers I like. Let's see.
Ooh, Halloween, Dawn of the Dead, Suspiria. Yeah. There's a lot of great stuff.
Oh, Deep Red, too.
Oh, Deep Red, yeah. A lot of the Argento. I mean, I put, for me, again, this The Brood is really a big deal to me. So I would put it up against some of that best stuff. But that's personal, you know. I could see how somebody else would look at it and say, it's minor, the budget really hinders it as far as the appeal, but I just think it's a great story and very creepy.
It's really different too. You know, a lot of the movies we just threw out there are slasher movies or giallo movies or
psychological. Bodies. Yeah,
yeah, and some are art actually. Like The Devils is an art horror film, which Oliver Reed was in.
Is he good?
Mention that one.
Yeah,
I can't wait to see that now after hearing them talk about it, but I haven't seen it yet.
Gosh, it's amazing, amazing film. Sorry.
Oh no, it's okay. The science horror. I don't really think there's a comparison in the 70s. I don't see any. I think you know, like Reanimator in the 80s. You definitely saw that.
Alien maybe, I guess. Not exactly.
Yeah. Well, we talked about that in the Shining episode. It is kind of a haunted house movie.
So we had a few technical issues there with the connection, so we have lost Brian, but we're going to just finish up with Cronenberg and, of course, do our outro. So
I just hope the Brood didn't get him. I was sending very positive thoughts his way, but...
I think it was the Teletubbies.
The Skype of Tubbies. So sorry, it was great having Brian. We're almost finished anyway, so it's probably as good time to lose him as any. But he's awesome, and I loved his input here.
Oh yeah, yeah, loved having Brian. And we'll let folks know where to find him in a bit. But we just want to, as we kind of finish up with the early Cronenberg, I should say. We were talking about 1970s films, and wondering, Aaron, what do you think about them? Are they still relevant today?
I think The Brood is certainly relevant to horror, to Cronenberg. Definitely is. I think we've more than established here. I think The Brood has influenced other horrors. There's lots of body. Sure. In fact, we mentioned Society. You know, Society probably was influenced by The Brood. I already mentioned some of the science. I'm sure there's plenty more that I'm not thinking of, but Reanimator, Lawnmower Man, some of the Stephen King stuff. There's a little bit of a scientific basis there. So yeah, I think it's important. I think some of the earlier works like Shivers, Rabid, you know, they're okay. I kind of like having my steel books of them as a collector, just as a fan sort of. But I wouldn't say we wouldn't know those if not for The Brood.
Right. Yeah, and I mean for me, I think they are relevant just from the scientific, the body horror aspect. I mean, I like to see how he kind of influenced other films, like you said. I mean, you wouldn't get. He just focuses on, I guess it's called teratology, the science or study of monstrosities and abnormal formations. I mean, I just love seeing kind of how he takes an idea and really makes, you know, manifests it as something physical. So,
I think that's really that's what makes his films work too, is because this is, even though it's science that maybe you and I don't understand, you know, he does sell it as possible in this crazy world we're living, you know, where you know, diseases exist. You know, virus exists.
Right.
I mean, they're not really in people's armpits, but
right. You never know. Yeah, I mean, and you can see some parallels too. I mean, just with like Shivers is. You could see some parallels like with AIDS and, you know, other sexually transmitted diseases.
Oh, sure.
I mean, you know, it's a easy parallel to make, but yeah, I mean, it takes that, maybe it makes it more real, you know, just a physical mm-hmm. gross manifestation of it can kind of, you know, make that fear more real. So, yeah.
And also his influence, I think just as an effects perspective, because the films we talked about that were being made, you know, effects-wise, this actually seems more like an '80s film. So I think that
yeah.
a lot of people saw these films and in the '80s tried to replicate them. So
sure.
I think it's more relevant in that regard.
Yeah, that's a great point. So, any other final thoughts on early Cronenberg, Aaron?
I think it's a fun exploration. I think I'm ready for his next era more than this one, but I do admire it. So it's been a fun discussion. Again, sorry we lost Brian at the end, but I really loved his points, and I thought they were. You can tell he knows his horror and he knows Cronenberg. So.
Yeah, I love Brian's enthusiasm and you know his appreciation of these films. So not everyone does, and it's but I think part of it too is just the era that we grew up in. Like I mentioned, you know, just knowing. You know, these films and growing up with some of the 80s horror films, it informs where we are today a little bit. So it's cool. Well, that's our show for today. Again, thanks for joining us. That's the early Cronenberg films from the 70s and The Brood. So we did lose Brian there, so we just want to let folks know where to find him. It's Brian Sauer. He is his name is Rupert Pupkin online on Twitter. He is at Bob Freelander. On Twitter. You can also find him at RupertPupkinSpeaks.com, and he joins Ryan Gallagher, our friend at Criterion Cast, on the Off the Shelf podcast. It's a weekly podcast where they talk about rumors and upcoming and recent releases and what they're excited about. So always great to engage with him.
Yeah, everything Brian is doing, I encourage people to check it out. It's all good stuff. So, and I was thrilled to have him today. So,
and where can folks find you online, Aaron?
Twitter, AWest505, CriterionBlues.com. I always forget what to say on these things.
I know. We have our fingers in so many places. And you can find me. I'm at Mark Herney, H-U-R-N-E is the last name on Twitter. Letterboxd is M-H-U-R-N-E. And a blog that I started and need to get out there some more is Movie Musings and Podcastings.com. And you can find the show at CriterionCU on Twitter, and you can email us at feedback@CriterionCloseUp.com. And as always, we like to plug, we'd love some more iTunes reviews. Keep them coming. We love the feedback and really appreciate everything that you can do there to get us more exposure. We really appreciate it. And next week, we are going to be delving into, as Aaron talked about before, David Lynch's Mulholland Drive coming out this Tuesday. So big release, maybe at least for a single title, the release of the year, I would think. So we'll delve into that next week.
Yeah, close to Apu, but yeah,
exactly.
Cannot wait for that. So yeah.
So thanks again for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.
Silencio.